Before we start with Ramosha, who we're going to be focusing on today, I just want to mention a few more things of people who contacted me after last week. First, my father pointed out that among the, we are speaking about rabbis whose children became conservative and reform, and he pointed out one I didn't even realize. Rabbi Gerstenfeld's son became a leading reform rabbi in Washington, D.C. Now, Rabbi Gerstenfeld, for those who don't know, was one of the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan, the same time as Rav Soloveitchik. He died, I guess, in the early 60s. He was the only Hungarian, and he was really the only one who was a focus on practical halacha. Before the RCA had a Beis Din, Yeshiva University had a Beis Din. He was the Av Beis Din. In fact, most people went to yeshiva wanted to be Talmidim or Rav Soloveitchik, and that was the big thing. But for those who were not into this Brisker stuff, who wanted a more halachic-oriented approach, you could become a Talmud of Rav Gerstenfeld, never take Rav Soloveitchik. For example, Rabbi Louis Bernstein was never a student of Rav Soloveitchik. He was a student of Rav Gerstenfeld. I also mentioned last time that Edgar Borah helped get Ramosha's visa. He was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations. My father also pointed out his name is William Edgar Borah. And finally, my father pointed out, I was speaking about this Rabbi Morris Adler, and I forgot to mention something. He was the son of the Rosh Yeshiva of Tiferes Yerushalayim, who died, who drowned. What I forgot to mention was that he's famous in his own right, not merely for the tshuva on driving on Shabbos, but in the 1960s, he was shot in shul by a congregant. In fact, a whole book was written about this called Murder in the Synagogue, and they named part of the highway in Michigan after him. So he's famous in his own right. Now, we ended last time talking about Avraham Shapiro, and just briefly, those who haven't been hearing the news, he was in the news significantly last week, and I think it's worth mentioning only because I think a lot of what we're doing in these lectures is showing that Orthodoxy is and can be very dynamic. Now, a lot of people don't realize that, and what was dynamic about this week? Well, some of you might have seen this picture. Let me move it down here. They look like Haredim, but because they wear black, but they're not. A group of religious Zionist rabbanim on the Temple Mount. Now, when I was younger, I'm sure the same with all of you, one thing we knew was that Orthodox Jews didn't go on the Temple Mount. That was for the UJA to take the Reform and the Conservative, and for hundreds of years, no one would ever dream of going on it. And yet last week on Yom Yerushalayim, a proclamation was made by not fringe people, Temple Mount faithful, big Rabbanim, Rabbi Riskin, Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, the Rav of Ramat Gan, who after Rav Avram Shapiro Mordechai Yahu is the leading postdoc for the religious Zionists, Rav Lior of Kiryat Arba, the new Rosh Yeshiva of Har Etzion, Rav Yaakov Maidan, the Rosh Kolo of Har Etzion, Rav Levi, Rav Rabinovich of Mali Adumim, and about 30 other Rabbanim calling upon Orthodox Jews to go on the Temple Mount. And this was and I know people, by the way, who in the past year have been. I still haven't been. But it does seem like it's becoming pretty mainstream for the modern Orthodox. I don't know what I'm going to do, what other people are going to do. But you have all these people calling, and Rav Avram Shapiro on Yom Yerushalayim in Merkaz Harav spoke very strongly against going up on the Temple Mount. But I don't know if it has any effect. It just shows how Orthodoxy is changing before our eyes, something which, and you still see the sign from the Rabbanut, but now it's become, it's like it's just another way to do things, that if you want to go on the Mount, I'll go. It's like you keep 2 days Yom Tov Shani, or 1 day, or 1.5, it's now an option. I wonder what Rav Schachter would say, because he's pretty much on the right politically, so it's amazing, the leading rabbinic figures, other than Rav Avram Shapiro and Mordechai Yahu, are telling people to go on the Temple Mount, so that's interesting. Yes, we can do that too. Okay, but let's pick up Stanley Emerson's clicking his thing by mistake. So let's pick up where we were last class. I don't see, let me go up to see if anyone had any other comments. See, Stanley, we'll wait till he figures out what's happening there, and then we'll move on. Technical support? Okay, we got it. Someone asked, what parts of Har HaBayit? Well, that's the question. they've determined what parts you can go on and what parts you can't go on. But as I said, I think it's fascinating that after hundreds of years of Jews refusing to go on, it's something we all knew as children, and even up until a couple of years ago that you couldn't do it, now we're being told by the leading rabbanim and the religious Zionist order, many of them, that it's our obligation to go up there to show that it's part of the Jewish, it belongs to the Jewish people, etc. So I don't know, Rabbi Kelman, I guess when you lead your next group to Israel, you'll have to decide what you're going to do. Okay, now I mentioned we got to Rav Shapiro because I said that he pointed out something really interesting, and once you hear it, it's not so profound, but I think the fact that he said it, and not some university type, is significant. He said that if you look at the great post-game, and he listed some, the Noda Yehuda, Rebbe Tzolchan, I'm going to go down the list. Almost invariably, they're known as great Mekilim. If they're not like the conservative, let's say, post-game, who are, you can pretty much say they're always going to be Mekil, but they are Mekil much more than not. And it's no accident that they became known as the great poskim, because people asking shilas, this is where Shapiro explained, went to people whom they knew had a reputation for being makel, because they wanted to get a makel decision. So the people are the ones who build up poskim, because they send the questions to them, and the ones, they're not, the people are not going to be building up great machmirim. People are always telling them that it's usser. So, and I think we can apply this to Rav Moshe Feinstein as well, and the pattern repeats itself. Although, as we shall see with reform, he was very machmir, from our perspective, although there is a lenient element, in general, his psakim are lenient again and again, kula after kula, including some very radical kula that we'll see today, some very radical kula, especially in family law. Now, you mentioned the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is not really a posek. He didn't become known. His sefer became popular, but in his day, he was not really known as a posek. He was not a communal rav. All the poskim, as we'll see today, were communal rabbanim. He really became better known through his sefer, and much more posthumously. In his lifetime, he wasn't. The Aruch HaShulchan was regarded as more significant than him. And you mentioned the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish is interesting as well. The Chazon Ish would appear to part with the pattern because he certainly was always a machmir. But I still think that for the most part, Rav Shapiro's insight is valid. And we can ask ourselves why. You know, what led people to go to the Chazon Ish? Remember, the Chazon Ish, it was not individuals, as we'll speak about today. This was a community of Haredim. We're not speaking of Balabatim. Every communal Rav has Balabatim. And the Balabatim are not going to go to Machmirim. The Chazon Ish, this is a community of scholars, which is quite unique. And we'll get back to that, because Rav Moshe is the last postake, as I'll argue later today, other than Rav Avadia, Rav Moshe is the last postake who speaks to the community. All the other postkim today don't. For reasons that I'll try to explain, you can obviously agree or disagree. I don't think there's anything wrong, incidentally, with individuals or rabbanim turning to Rav Moshe because they thought they'd get the answer they wanted, any more than there's a problem with Rav Moshe setting out to try to find kulas. After all, when we deal with especially these family issues, mamzeri, magunas, that's the job of the posek, to try to free the woman. And there's nothing wrong, I think, with people turning to a posek in that regard. So this, I think, is the first reason why Rav Moshe became such an important posek, that he was willing to take on all issues, as we spoke about last week, and he was lenient. He was a big mekil. That's the first important issue. He was fearless. Who but Rav Moshe would decide all the cases? And we also have to discuss another point that I mentioned last time. That is that Rav Moshe was a posek, and that's a big deal. Lithuanians were, for the most part, not poskim. Ever since Rav Chaim Soloveitchik revolutionized Torah study, what Lithuanians were great poskim? They were all great Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Moshe stood out among the Litvaks. What other Litvak was a posek? So to have a posek from Lithuania, of Rav Moshe's stature, was very significant. And not surprisingly, everyone went around him. But don't think that people followed Rav Moshe consistently. It's not true. You often hear people saying that you have to find a posek and follow him consistently. And maybe that should be the way it's done. But in the real world, that's not how it's done. The Orthodox community, let's take in America and Canada, relied on Rav Moshe for all sorts of decisions, very famous ones like Chol of Yisrael, the height of the Mechitza, Shevi and Chol HaMoed, and many more. Yet Rav Moshe was also Machmir on occasion. For example, Rav Moshe states in Igros Moshe, the first volume, it's Or HaChaim, number 111, that you can't use liquid soap on Shabbos. And in his tshuva, he says that in his house, they didn't use it. And yet, I have never met anyone who holds of this and who doesn't use liquid soap on Shabbos. In fact, I asked someone, a very important member of Ramosha's own family, and he uses liquid soap on Shabbos. So here's a perfect example. I'm getting to that one, Rabbi Hirsch. Very good. It would be interesting, incidentally, to ask Ramosha's leading students, do they use liquid soap? It's one thing, we understand why people didn't follow it. And Ramosha himself says that they were accustomed to using it. It's one thing to leave a stringent practice and follow Ramosha for leniency, but to go the other way, that's hard. Another example of a chumrah. We just, Rabbi Hirsch and Rabbi Kelman, the Shabbos clocks. According to Rav Moshe, you cannot use Shabbos clocks for anything but lights. That is, you can't use it for fans or anything else. And he also thinks that you shouldn't use it for lights, but he says he's not going to push the issue because the people are already accustomed to it. But in theory, but he certainly didn't think it was proper. And yet, does anyone follow Rav Moshe on this? Do any of his students? I'm talking about Talmidim Muvhakim, like Rabbi Greenblatt from Memphis and other big students. We can discuss maybe another time. We don't have time now. What are the parameters of following post schemes? You have to follow them consistently. Rav Lichtenstein speaks a little bit about this in one of his essays. But the fact remains that although the Orthodox community, and not just the modern Orthodox community, even the Haredim, followed Rav Moshe for many things, they didn't follow him for a lot. And it's not like they had worked out a theory why not. It was too difficult. It didn't fit in with the way Orthodoxy was going. So it's quite interesting. Before looking at a couple of his major psukim that really had an impact and created great controversy, at least one of them, I think we also need to point out that his influence is not what it was when he died 21 years ago. It has declined. And truthfully, it's only the rare person whose influence increases after his death. We mentioned with Rav Cook and Rav Weinberg that their influence has increased. Rav Soloveitchik's influence has certainly increased. He is much more influential now than he ever was in his lifetime. We just celebrated Yom HaTzimut. You can see there how Rav Soloveitchik was not so influential just by looking at how we celebrate Yom HaTzimut. The Rav was totally opposed to this. In his lifetime, he was the Rav. He was a Rebbe for so many. But even his leading students did not accept him when it came to religious Zionism. And yet today, his word is like, God forbid to even disagree with what the Rav said if you're in the so-called modern Orthodox world. There's other figures, the Minchas Chinuch, but for the most part, Gedolim, their influence, their significance declines, and that is certainly the case with Rav Moshe. If Rav Yoshev today would give a psak, as he has, in opposition to Rav Moshe, you'll find the people pretty much following Rav Yoshev. And let me give you two easy examples to illustrate this. Rav Moshe was very opposed to an Erev in Brooklyn. He was also opposed to the Manhattan Erev, but he states explicitly that there are many Rabbanim, Rav Henkin, and others who support the Manhattan Erev, and if people want to carry in Manhattan based upon the Erev they established, they have upon who to rely, and he's not going to protest. However, when it came to the Brooklyn Erev, he was very strongly opposed to it. He published in the newspapers against it. And during his lifetime, you really could not get an Erev off the ground. He was that important. Within 10 years after his passing, you had a variety of different Erevin, particularly put up by Hasidim, and I just spoke to someone today, and he estimates that approximately 50% of the people, both the Hasidim, the more modern Orthodox, approximately 50% of the people, even some Haredim, Litvish Haredim, carry in the Erev in Brooklyn. Something, and that's a sign of how people ignoring a chumrah of Moshe, showing how his influence is not what it was during his lifetime. So we have many, mainly Hasidic people. But I also was told that more of the modern, the young Israel types are carrying as well, many of them. And over time, it'll become more and more accepted, presumably, because it's almost impossible to live in today's day and age without an Erev. And all you need is a great Litvish apostate to come on the scene and say, I think it's permissible. And then the Litvish people will forget about Rav Moshe and they'll move on. It's happened many times before. The Hasidim didn't hold by Rav Moshe, but they didn't go against him publicly. They wouldn't break with him about the Erev because he was that influential. So I'm told even by people living there. Perhaps I'm understanding, but that was the sense I was given. I spoke today to two people. Correct me if I'm wrong. I can tell you in Boston, to give you another example, during the whole time the Rav was active, they didn't put an Erev up. Even though who holds like the Briskers? Oh, I was living in Boston at the time. Only when the Rav was ill and was not active, then they set up the Erev. And really, there was no need for it because the Rav himself said that he used to check the Erev every week in Brisk when he was a youngster. And even though his grandfather, didn't hold from it, not in Brisk, in Chaslovich, even though his father didn't hold from it, they still had an Erev. So it's hard to say. I think the same situation happened in Chicago. Out of respect for Aaron Soloveitchik, they didn't put up an Erev during his lifetime. Okay, they broke his windows. I'll get to the breaking of the windows. It's not about the Erev. It's about another thing. Okay, I agree. But during Rav Moshe's lifetime, the Rabbanim didn't dare. The modern Orthodox Rabbanim wouldn't go and put up an Erev there. Today it's different. That's what I think is an example. Another example, and this is moving in the direction of rejecting the kula of Rav Moshe, is and going in the direction of stringency, and that's Rav Moshe has a famous tshuva, a famous response to Rabbi Pinchas Teitz. I went to his school, the great Rav of Elizabeth, perhaps the last very important pulpit rabbi before the takeover by the Rosh Yeshiva that I'll speak about later today. Rabbi Teitz had written to Rav Moshe wanting to know, what is the base? Had previously had non-kosher wine, and it would appear to be a problem. And Rav Moshe writes a tshuva to him. Okay, now Joey points out, I don't know if you were on, Joey, the first minute. I pointed out that's ironically exactly what Avraham Shapiro says, a great post-take in our time. It's interesting, I point that out only because the academics, of course, would understand that, but to have a great post-take point out that part of the post-schemes, part of the post-ex reputation is exactly what Edward Fram mentions there, that the Baal HaBat team are not going to ask him questions. We'll get, in a few minutes, maybe we'll talk about the Chazon Ish, where you're dealing with the yeshiva community that wants chumras, they will dafka ask someone who they think is going to be machmir. It's a good point. But what is the example of rejection of Ramosha? I think it's not just that. I think it's whenever there are Baal HaBat team. The note of Yehuda is before that. I just think that's the way. Baal HaBatim, they don't want the rabbi to make their life more difficult than it is. So they're always going to, this is a new phenomenon that people are getting. I know Chaim Soloveitchik was a little cynical, but if you look at the end, the last sentence of his famous article, he says that since we've lost the connection, the inner connection, the immediate connection to God, our only connection is to the yoke of the law. So we have to make our life more difficult by adding on halachas, adding on chumrah. But when people lived an inherent connection, they lived a complete Jewish life, that's not the way they related to God. They felt God every day. They didn't need the law. So, and thank you for corroborating this. What's the other example I'm talking about? As I said, this wine case, Rav Moshe writes a tshuva, and he explains how it's not a problem halachically. It is all, I mean, there's a famous tshuva in Ode of Yehuda where he speaks about using containers that had mamish treif in it. You know, there's all, what is permissible according to halacha and what we do today are two very different things. So Rav Moshe says, 100% permissible, no problem. And this is how matters stood for 50 years. Until about 3 years ago, the OU threw out a trial balloon. And in their magazine, Jewish Action, you can check it, it's online, fall of 2004, they actually published an article explaining why whiskey needs to have a hashgacha. And also on their website, which I checked this morning, you can find an article there on this topic in which they cite Rav Moshe, and they also cite him in his tshuva. He does say that a very pious person should not drink these whiskeys. And Rav Moshe says that he himself is stringent generally, but if people are having l'chaim, or if he's at shul and they're drinking, he too joins in. And that what he says is it's 100% kosher. There's no reason not to. But if you want to be super pious, you can abstain from it. And yet the website, the OU's article concludes on the website, quote, after showing all the reasons why you shouldn't accept Rav Moshe, you should consult your local Orthodox rabbi about what to do with regard to single malt and blended scotch. Now, this is a perfect example of how Rav Moshe's influence has declined in this area, and I assume perhaps also of the chumrah craze. Why would anyone need to consult their, quote, local Orthodox rabbi when the Posek Hador, the Posek Vertudars, already told you that it's 100% kosher? Isn't Rav Moshe good enough for me? There we have the quote from Chaim Soloveitchik. If my local rabbi disagrees with Rav Moshe, shouldn't I hold like Rav Moshe? But perhaps maybe not. Maybe your local rabbi is now holding like Rav Yoshev or a different Rav. Maybe you're not supposed to. JJ points out, and Jonathan, that I'll get to this, that some of you might be cynical and say that there's a lot of money to be made. You know, after putting hashgacha on the laundry detergents and on the toilet bowl cleaners, and by the way, there are hashgachas on toilet bowl cleaners, don't take my word for it, go to the OU website, and all these other things, candles, you say, well, here's... I don't think that's all there is to it, though. I think that there's more to it than that. I look, lots of things that Rav Moshe thought were acceptable are no longer acceptable. Since we just mentioned kashrus, let's continue along those lines. Rav Moshe didn't eat glot. None of the packages of food that Rav Moshe had, or anyone, of course, had the symbol DE on them. Rav Moshe has a tshuva in which he says that you can trust a company. When a company tells you, for example, that there's vegetable shortening, not animal shortening, you can trust the company. All these things would never fly today among what we can call, for example, the new Orthodox, Chol Yisrael. Of course, have you ever seen a pizza shop that's not Chol Yisrael? I mean, there's been a lot of changes. But here we have an author in an OU publication telling us that we shouldn't rely on Rav Moshe. And again, like, you could be cynical and say it's all about money. I don't think so. I don't think it's all about it. Now, I don't think, by the way, that this article will have any influence whatsoever. Since unlike other, and I haven't heard anything from it, I remember calling the OU after this appeared 3 years ago and asking them about it, and they try sort of backtracked when I spoke to someone on the phone saying, well, we're not saying you have to, we're not going to not give hashgachas to places. But this is an example of a chumrah which I don't think can ever take off for the simple reason that the Hasidim can never go along with it. The Hasidim have seen their rebbes for the last 200 years every Shabbos drink schnapps. Now, maybe a litvak could stomach the notion that, you know, maybe the gedolim were doing something, it wasn't 100% correct, we're going to do it better. But for a chassid to assume that his rebbe did something which wasn't 100% correct and maybe had a chashash of treif, every Shabbos when he sees his rebbe, so obviously they can never accept it. And I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't seen any shul in the country, I go to a lot of shuls, which have taken the schnapps out. I heard of one shul up in Brookline in which they removed, after this article appeared, they took all the schnapps out, but I'm sure they put it back by now, so I don't think this could ever have... we'll get to smoking at the very end. Let's move on. But I do think it's interesting that here we have examples of Rav Moshe in which the people just won't accept it. And I think the last example is amazing, because you think on a kashrus thing, which is we've been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years, to actually try to turn things around and say that what everyone has ever done is wrong, or it's not the best thing, that I think is significant. And it just shows that what is today called orthodoxy has moved beyond what traditional Judaism, or at least what Rav Moshe regarded as traditional Judaism. Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of his significant rulings, a few significant rulings, and get a sense of the man. The anti-Kiddush Club, was that a factor in the article? I don't think so, because as soon as you have OU schnapps, you can have the Kiddush Club again. I don't know if that was a factor in it. Good question. Read the article. They don't mention the Kiddush Club. They just, and it's a little bit, in my opinion, chutzpah. The author of this article, who's a rabbi, I'm sure Talmud Chacham, working for the OU, he feels he could take on Rav Moshe and quote reasons why Rav Moshe is wrong and why we shouldn't rely on Rav Moshe, and then conclude that you know, it's not the best thing. I mean, look, we're not dealing with one of the Gedolim Hashem Aretz here. You know, if Rav Schechter wants to write it, or Rebelsky or something, but to just have someone works there trying to show why we shouldn't rely on Rav Moshe, I mean, I just thought it was a little chutzpahdik. Now, Rav Moshe's growing importance coincided with the usurpation of a traditional rabbinic authority in American Orthodoxy from the communal rabbanim, Until the 1950s, Agudas Rabbanim, which was made up of communal Rabbanim, they ran Orthodoxy in America, as they ran Orthodoxy all over the world. Communal Rabbanim were the post-scheme. They were making decisions. This began to change in the 1950s when power moved to the Rosh Yeshiva. And truthfully, they were correct, the Rosh Yeshiva, that they were more learned than a typical communal rabbi. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that to be a rabbi today, who has time to learn when you're a rabbi? In Europe, your job was to answer shilas, give some halachic drushas, and learn, and visit the shochim, things like that. Today, the rabbi has to be at all the different events and visit the sick, and there's a social worker, and his schedules are so busy. So truthfully, the rabbi doesn't have the time to sit and learn like they used to. But these were still old European, as they would say, Europeish rabbanim, who were being pushed aside by the Rosh Yeshiva coming in and their followers, who now started going to yeshiva. When they came back to their cities, no longer did they give loyalty to the Marad Asra, even though these were great Talmidei Chachamim. Their loyalty was to the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rosh Yeshiva, as an intercommunal figure, having influence all over, began to usurp the authority. Agudas Rabbanim was the most important rabbinic organization. It was founded, I believe, in 1902, right after Rav Yaakov Yosef died, and it had all the big American rabbanim from Europe. And, for example, it was the biggest, the most important rabbinic organization until in the 1960s it began to be usurped by the RCA. The reason the RCA was created was because the Agudas Rabbanim refused to allow Reitz graduates. These were rabbis who came from Europe, who were Bekiim, all of them, and Shas and Poskim, and they didn't want to have these RCA rabbis. They didn't think that they were up to their level. And what happened was, of course, that in the 1950s into the 60s, as the American community no longer understood these Yiddish-speaking rabbis with no college educations, the YU rabbis began to dominate, and the RCA became bigger, and the Agudas Rabbanim, they were the ones, by the way, who were very much involved in Vod Hatzalah. They led the march on Washington during the Holocaust, but they officially closed up, I believe, in the early 1990s. The last presidents were Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Rav Tuvia Stern, Rav Tibor Stern, and Rav Moshe Feinstein was the head of Agudas Rabbanim, Rav Yaakov Kamenetzer, Rav Aaron Cutler, all the great Rabbanim. And in the 1950s, the power in Agudas Rabbanim went from the rabbis to the Rosh Yeshiva until, towards the end, there were no longer any Rabbanim. The Rosh Yeshiva were running it, but these were the classic American Rabbanim. And since I mentioned OU, I should tell you that they had battles against the OU. Oh, let me tell you about this. First of all, they didn't think the OU was from, because the OU had hundreds of shuls, non-machitza shuls. So they said the OU was not a firm organization. And then when it came to kashrus, in the 1960s, the OU began taking hashkachas, became a big organization. They were taking hashkachas away from these rabbanim. These European rabbanim made their livings, many of them, on hashkachas. These were not, they didn't have any other skills. They came to America. Many of them couldn't speak English that well. They made livings on hashkachas. And here the OU, for their purposes, I understand why, was trying to make it into a business, was coming in and taking away these hashkachas. They could offer lower prices, and not only that, they began, the idea began to go around that these rabbanim were not reliable, that one rabbi cannot be responsible for hashkachas, you need a whole organization. There's a tshuva in Rav Moshe about this. He doesn't mention the OU, but he's referring to the big organization taking away these rabbis' hashkachas. But it got to the point that, like, today, people have this opinion that if it's not one of the major organizations, you can't trust a Rabbi Ralbag, let's say. You can only trust the big organizations. And The Agudas Rabbanim had terrible battles against the OU and then against the OK, and they didn't regard it as a reliable organization. And, of course, you see what happens. As their influence increased and the Agudas Rabbanim declined, today, who remembers the Agudas Rabbanim? And you don't really have these private hashkachas, although I'll tell you something very ironic. We're told all the, you know, so much about Rabbi Ralbag's hashkacha, not reliable, this and that. First, I'll tell you, their chief rabbinate of Israel accepts it. But more ironic, the RCA is now, all these RCA rabbis go to all their websites and they tell you about the hashkachas that are reliable, never Rabbi Ralbag, who happens to be, by the way, a huge Talmid Chacham. At the moment, he also serves as the chief rabbi of the Netherlands. He goes there for a week every 2 months. And in the Netherlands, incidentally, and in Europe, he's regarded as one of the Gedolim. But, you know, if he's not reliable, then the mikvahs and the restaurants and hashkacha and everything in the Netherlands is treif. But be that as it may, When the rabbinate of Israel came out with its list of the dayanim who will be accepted for conversion, which caused all this problem with the RCA and is still causing all these problems, there are only a few in the New York area. One was Rabbi Peretz Steinberg of Kew Gardens, one was Rabbi Teitz of Elizabeth, and one was Rabbi Ralbag. And that was, and no RCA rabbis were on it. So the RCA, which is spending all this time telling us that Ralbag is not reliable, the chief rabbin is now telling the RCA rabbis that they're not reliable, and Ralbag, he is reliable. So I don't know. Do with it what you want. But Rabbi Ralbag's father is a holdover from the old Agudas Rabbanim. In fact, at the Agudas Rabbanim were the ones who got together and put Mordechai Kaplan in Chayrim and burnt his siddur. It was Rabbi Ralbag Sr., who now is about 95 years old. He was the one who actually burnt Mordechai Kaplan's siddur. It created a terrible Chil Hashem. This was 1945. The Nazis are burning Jews and burning Jewish books. And here you have Agudas Rabbanim burning the siddur. But I asked Rabbi Ralbag, did he do this on his own, or was it a Agudas Rabbanim thing? And he actually said that he did it on his own. So he didn't want Agudas Rabbanim to be blamed. But so he's an old-time Agudas Rabbanim person now. Yes, a good mess. Okay, so that's what Agudas Rabbanim. Agudas Rabbanim were communal rabbis until the 1950s when the Rosh Yeshiva began to move in. And Rav Moshe benefits from this. In fact, before the only great posek I can think of, let's say, in the 19th century, early 20th century, who wasn't a communal rav was the Netziv, Rosh Yeshiva. But he, too, was the rabbi of Volozhin. So, really, they all were communal down the line. Just look at all the great volumes of Shilos and Shuvos. They always say the name of the Rav, and then they say, Av based in wherever he is, all the great poskim. Rav Henkin, of course, Rav Henkin was a postake in various cities. Rav Henkin was even out in Georgia. He was a postake, and then he came to America, and he got involved in Ezra's Torah, but he was a communal Rav. Yes, more people are going to. We'll talk about this in a minute. The influence of the Rosh Yeshiva reached its apex in 1956 with the famous ruling by a group of Rosh Yeshiva, no communal, it was 11 Rosh Yeshiva, no communal rabbis involved, they didn't even bother asking them. If you read the Hapardes from those years, Hapardes was the journal of the Agudas Rabbanim, there's complaints almost every issue. Why are the communal rabbanim being ignored? Why is it that at the events of Agudas Yisrael, for example, they don't ask rabbanim to speak, they only ask the Rosh Yeshiva? You know, there's a lot of, and they had this proclamation signed by 11 Rosh Yeshiva that it's forbidden to belong to mixed boards of rabbis, like the New York Board of Rabbis. Every city had a mixed board of rabbis. Or to have any involvement, Orthodox organizations with non-Orthodox lay organizations, such as the United Synagogue. You couldn't be on something called like the Synagogue Council of America, in which you have different groups. Now, this is something which is very common in the United States. Old-time European rabbanim were on these mixed board of rabbis. They thought it was important to get together with the other rabbis for communal reasons, to work with the government, all sorts of things. You had in Camden, New Jersey, was a grandson of the Netziv, Natali Tzuyuda Reif, beard down to here, long beard, big rabbanim. I don't know what the situation was in Canada. I don't know if Rabbi Gedalia Felder was on a mixed board, although I do know, and we have someone who can attest to this, at least I've been told by reliable authority, correct me if I'm wrong, Rabbi Kelman Sr., that he would get together with conservative and reform rabbis and give shiurim to them, and can that be confirmed that Rabbi Gedalia Felder used to do that?
I will tell you, as a junior here, and my father, I'm sure, can confirm more than I can, but I remember at the dinner when they honored Rabbi Felder when he already wasn't well, but they had a big dinner honoring him. And in the journal, there was a letter from Rabbi Plaut, who was sort of the leading Reform rabbi in Canada. I believe it made it into the journal. I for sure remember reading his article in Canadian Jewish News about it. It was a different world. Rabbi Felder commanded the respect of the Reform and the conservative rabbi, and he, although I will say, as far as I know, on a communal level, he didn't go against sort of the ruling of the Rosh Yeshivas from 1956. I am not aware.
I'm talking before 56.
Maybe other people are.
Now, I'm talking about before 1956, and you had big rabbanim who had relationships. You had Rabbi Leiter in Pittsburgh and many others, and as I said, you had European rabbanim who were on these boards, and here was a challenge to their authority now, telling them that all this was forbidden. I will tell you that these Rosh Yeshiva, the signers, included Rabbi Mendel Zaks, who was a Rosh Yeshiva Really, technically, he was the Bochein, but he was the son-in-law of the Chavetz Chaim at Yeshiva University, and Rav David Lifshitz. What's the reason? Why are they saying you can't do this? It's not like these Rabbanim were getting together with conservative reform and discussing theology. It was all done for the help of Klal Yisrael, to help on Shabbos and things like that. What was the reason? They didn't want to, this will answer JJ's question. They said it's giving legitimacy to the non-Orthodox rabbis in America. We have to fight against...
Can I talk now?
Yeah, someone who's talking. Excuse
Rabbi
me. Someone? Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly. Press down on the button again. We don't hear you, Rabbi Kelman. You have to press down...
Can you hear me? And he used to tell me the same thing that you said.
You have to press...
Oh, my wife is pressing.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
We hear you.
Am I doing the wrong thing? You can't hear me.
No, we hear you. Can we go on? We hear
go
you.
Go on.
Okay.
No, now we don't hear you.
I'll try again.
Okay.
The Rav was the outstanding authority. I mean, he used to complain that some guy would get married and bring his Rosh Yeshiva 2,000 miles away and give him a lot of letter and then to the Rav. And he was very specific about what has happened is not in the Jewish tradition. And he did, by the way, he was very close to reform, I mean, not close to reform rabbis, I don't want to say that. If his son was listening, he'd probably yell at me. His son was much more to the right than the father, which isn't always good. But he got along with the reform conservative rabbis, respected him, and for a couple of years, the Toronto rabbis had a board of rabbis, all three. Orthodox Reform, but then after a while, the Orthodox rabbis left. But for a number of years, you had Rabbi Felder, Nochum Rabinowitz, Maladumim. They helped organize the mixed Board of Rabbis in Toronto.
Okay, and there's a perfect example of a way forward. Rabbi Felder and all the Rabbanim of cities were very upset with their position being taken away to the Rosh Yeshiva, and it was the Rabbanim of the cities who thought it was valuable to have these mixed groups. The Rosh Yeshiva, who were not in the cities and didn't see the issues, they were speaking ideologically, and for their standpoint, it was ideologically vital not to give any what they said was legitimacy to the Reform or the conservative rabbis, and that's why they banned it. And I will tell you, to show the importance of the Rosh Yeshiva, it took only one generation for this ruling to achieve, I would say, basically near unanimous agreement. Shortly after it, it became very difficult for Orthodox Rabbanim to still be involved. Today you have the YCT, Yeshivas Chovei Torah rabbis, who are on these boards, and you still have a few holdouts maybe on the New York Board of Rabbis, but for the most part, Orthodox rabbis refuse to be on them, and today rabbis coming out of, let's say, the Yeshiva University, or certainly the other yeshivas, they won't be on them. You still have the mixed boards, but they will not have the Orthodox rabbis. You might have one or an occasional person, and the synagogue council closed up in 1994. It just became untenable. Now, Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav, he famously declined to sign this ban, this cherem, against these mixed boards. And Rav Moshe is said to have quipped that normally you can say shtika kohoda adamya, that when someone doesn't say something against it, you assume he agrees. But in this case, I think that the Rav, his silence is not acquiescence. And Rav Moshe was right, because privately the Rav told his students that there was no reason to leave the Synagogue Council of America. I don't know what he said about the mixed board of rabbis. He certainly never said it was forbidden, because he had students who remained on it. But I don't know if he ever encouraged people and said it's positive. But with the Synagogue Council of America, he thought it was a positive thing, as long as they didn't deal with theology. His leading Talmud, Walter Wurzberger, was president of it. And YCT graduates have indeed been blackballed by mainstream Orthodoxy. And one of the reasons is, they point out that you go to cities, like Phoenix is where one of the rabbis is having a lot of problems. He's the only Orthodox rabbi who will be on the mixed board. And it might not be good politics, you know. If all the other rabbanim don't do it, if you go on it, that means they're not going to let you on the Vada Kashrus, they're not going to let you do all sorts of things. So it becomes very, very difficult. Rav Moshe, Among these 11 Rosh Yeshiva, he was the only posek, the only one routinely issuing psak, writing tshuvot, so that further cemented his position as the posek of the Litvaks. All the Rosh Yeshiva, when they needed a psak, they went to Rav Moshe, they sent their students to Rav Moshe. So by 1956, he is the most important. Together with this, his reputation, you know, which is continues to grow, was accompanied by some very liberal, lenient, even radical, as we'll see, decisions in the area of Jewish family law. And it's a testament to his greatness and the great respect that he was given that in the Litvisher community, at least, his position was firm. And despite these rulings that I'll mention in a minute, it didn't affect his position. And in fact, as we will see in one famous case, what appears to be a great leniency is actually the most important, the most influential psak ever given in the 20th century. We don't have time to go into his attitude towards reform and conservative in any detail. Let me just say that his attitude was entirely negative. Unlike Rav Soloveitchik, for instance, who saw good, you know, he had good relationships with Rabbi Shubo and others, and he saw a lot of positive value, although he disagreed with them, obviously. Just take a look at the letter that Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote when he was asked to come to the dinner honoring Rabbi Shubo. He wrote a letter explaining why he couldn't go to the dinner, but that doesn't take away from the fact that he has great esteem for Rabbi Shubo and what he's doing. And there were conservative rabbis who used to come to the Rav Shirim. In fact, one of the rabbis who wrote the tshuva against using non-kosher wine was one of the Rav's Talmidim. And Rav Lichtenstein actually helped him write his tshuva, and it's an official tshuva. In the conservative movement, if you get a certain amount of votes, it becomes an official tshuva. So the Rav had a more open mind to that, although he could be dogmatic at certain times. Rav Moshe, he really had no patience for them. He saw them as heretics, no more, no less. Not the individuals, but the rabbis, the conservative and the reform rabbis. He did not regard them as religious leaders. He went so far as to say that if you're at, let's say, a UGA-type dinner and one of the conservative reform rabbis makes a bracha, you should not answer amen to it. You don't call, give them aliyahs. If you look in Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin's second volume, he takes issue with Rav Moshe on this giving aliyah to the reform rabbi. He thinks that you can give an aliyah, but he says if you want to add, you should add an extra aliyah, make it the eighth. He deals with a real case there about where the reform rabbi, the community felt they had to give him. We ask what his relationship was with modern orthodoxy. He was the posek for much of Rav Henkin and Rav Moshe. I'll give you, since we just finished Yom HaTzmaut, I'll give you a good story. Bnei Akiva in the 1950s, you know, they had heard that Rav Moshe wasn't so much in favor, and Rav Moshe was the posek for the modern Orthodox. When I say on big things, look, if you lived in the Bronx, you had a Rav Moshe Bick, but, I mean, he was a posek accepted by looking at the people he writes his tshuvas to. And let's not forget, they didn't have Haredim then in the 1950s. Almost all the Rabbanim were either the old-time European Rabbanim, almost all of whom were Mizrahi in America, and the YU rabbis. Look at who he's writing tshuvas to. These are Reitz graduates. So you didn't have Haredim then, but Bnei Akiva went to New York Bnei Akiva. They went to Rav Moshe, and they said to Rav Moshe, what about Yom HaTzmaut? You know, can they say Hallel? And Rav Moshe replied that... he says, by Mir, you know, for me, it's not such a chag. But if you think it's a chag, and if you want to say halal, you could say halal. I don't know. I don't think he's referring to saying with a bracha, but he understood well. Now, about the Israeli flag, tshuva, he was responding to people that, and truthfully, his tshuvas even reflect a more extreme view sometimes, because his balabatim were typical East Side New York balabatim. We're not talking about people like in Borough Park or Bnei Brak. These are old-time Jews, Zionists, the whole bit. These are not what we would call frum in the sense we think of today. These were lots of people in the Lower East Side, and this was a day when you have 5.5-day work week. You know how many people went to shul 6:30 in the morning? I mean, went to Shabbos morning so it could be done by 8, because they had to be at work at 8:30. They'd come home at 1. These are pious people. Rav Henkin writes about them. He says, Chas v'shalom, to consider them Mechalei Shabbos. That is, Mechalei Shabbos, that they're not regarded as good Jews, and that their wine is not kosher. He goes, these are good Jews who just, it's almost like an anus, like Rav Chaim Hirschenson. These are the Jews that Rav Moshe had to deal with. From Jews who were Mechalei Shabbos. I mean, we can't imagine what that means today, but these were the people who helped build American Orthodoxy. Many things. It's hard for us to imagine today this type of Judaism, but that's what Rav Moshe dealt with. But as for, let me move on then. I was going to talk more, but I see time is getting late. One of his most famous rulings, repeated in a number of places, relates to the status of civil marriages and especially reform marriages. Now, the question is, to start with civil marriages, do you need a get from a civil marriage? And there has probably been more written in stock on this topic, I've heard this from Rabbi Kefet, and I think it's correct, than any other topic, civil marriage. Now, what's the issue? The problem is obvious. If civil marriage is halachically valid, then we have hundreds of thousands of mamzerim running around. Because every woman who's civilly married then gets divorced, goes with someone else, and what are we going to do? We can't marry these people. You could not have a kirov movement. We'd be two separate people. So what to do? But why should a civil marriage be binding halachically? Well, for the simple reason that the man and woman are living together. You don't need to have a chuppah. You don't need a rabbi for a marriage. You don't need brachot. You don't need a big ceremony, a big party. All you need is a man in front of two people to give an object of value and say, with this you are betrothed. And the Yemenites, even into the mid-20th century, they would get married just like that. They didn't have ceremonies. They would just be mekadesh someone. Interesting. where were we? Yes. So if this is what binds you together, then obviously you would need a get. Well, civil marriages obviously don't have, you don't give an object of value, but remember what the famous Mishnah says, you don't just need an object of value. There's other ways to betroth the woman, and when you betroth the woman, you need a get. One is with a shtar. What's a shtar? Now, this has not been done for many centuries. I looked it up today, actually, in the Shulchan Aruch. If you look at Evan Ezra or Lama Beis, he discusses it. It's a special shtar, a special document, which has to be written l'shma for them, just like a get needs to be written. No one does this anymore, though. We all do it with the money. If you want to be a troublemaker when you get married, tell your rabbi that you want to get married with a shtar. Why not? You teach people. In fact, I will tell you that it probably would be a good idea if we were married today with a shtar, not with money. It would save us a lot of problems. All the volumes of Tshuvot, and I'm talking about going back hundreds of years when boys and girls were not supposed to mix, but all the great volumes of Tshuvot have cases of where a boy was just joking around with a girl and gave the girl some object of money and said, with this you're betrothed to me. You know, what's the status of the girl? All the great collections of Tshuvos discussed this. There was even a case like this in JC when I was in Elizabeth Yeshiva at a basketball game where the boy was Makadish the girl. And it's a real question which needs poskim to answer. And you might say, well, what's the big deal? Just give a get. You don't want to give a get like that, because then the woman can't marry a Kohen, so it's a serious thing. Now, these people obviously have seen weddings. They know that you give an object of value. If the Hamonam, if the ignorant masses thought that the only way you get married is through a shtar, then you wouldn't have boys every year in summer camp. There's some case like this where some guy gives a girl, you know, an object of value. You wouldn't have any of these cases. So, truthfully, I think it would probably be a good thing. You know, I wonder if the reason we're accustomed to be Mekadesh, a woman with a ring, it might even be a non-Jewish practice. The earliest reference to it is the Gaonic writings. It's not in the Gemara. I've never investigated further, but certainly other things regarding the wedding are non-Jewish. These processions we have in America and Canada and England with all the family members, with the best man and the flower girl. I've been told that in Israel, they gather around. This is not typical traditional Jewish thing, these long processions with the music. It's really Victorian. Certainly the practice of standing up for the bride and groom when they walk down the aisle, I can tell you that 30 years ago even, no one stood up, or 40 years ago, so I'm told, people do not stand up for the bride and groom. I don't know how, now it's become a chiyuv, obligatory. Maybe some of the old-timers here can tell us if they remember this. Rabbi Teitz said that he didn't remember, and apparently today someone told me that Reuven Feinstein refuses to stand up. Well, he can do that, but I think if you were to not stand up, they'd think you're a mechutzav. They think that you're disrespecting the bride and groom. So we have lots of practices. And for heaven's sakes, what about the engagement ring? I mean, I don't know where this notion of an engagement ring comes from, that we give it a diamond engagement ring. That was never a tradition. But so in any event, you have lots of things that have seeped in. Now, what's the other way you can have a marriage? That's through sex, bia. Now, obviously, living together with all the world to see accomplishes that. So therefore, you have people living together, the whole world sees this, that's a marriage, and you need then to have a get. Now, and that was Rav Henkin's position, and that was many other Gedolim's positions. Joey points out, no one stands up for the grandparents. You're right. You should stand up for the Zaken. And some people have tried to make the argument of the Chassan's like a king or something. You know, that's in Pirkei Dror Ezer. But usually I've seen people, they don't stand for the Chassan. They only stand for the Kala. You know, give the... You know, whatever. All I can say, someone should really do a nice article on this, because I've spoken to older people, Rabbanim, and they don't remember this when they were married. It does seem like this is a practice that's developed in the last 30 years. And I don't know where it came from. But all I can say is it's now a chiyuv. You must stand up, or you're breaking with minhag hamakom. Rabbi Kalman says last 15 years at most. You know, I don't know. It's quite interesting. I have to ask Rabbi Sperber. You know, he claims that this is the last. His new book of minhagim just came out, and he says they say this is the last one. But there's plenty of other minhagim he hasn't dealt with. So let's get him to work on this one as well. Rav Henkin actually ruled, along with many other Gedolim, that civil marriages needed to get. After all, why not? Rav Henkin even went further. Rav Henkin thought that you have sometimes these engagement parties where at the engagement party, you give the girl, you announce your engagement, and you give the girl in front of everyone the engagement ring, rather than most people, I think, do it more privately, but there's plenty of people who have these engagement parties. Rav Henkin felt that engagement ring is the equivalent of being the Kadesh HaSaisha. You don't need to then be under the chuppah with another ring. You've actually, and it creates, and it's a real problem. So many people were choshesh for Rav Henkin and wouldn't have these engagement parties. But if we follow Rav Henkin's position and the other Rabbanim's position, we're stuck with this problem of hundreds of thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of mamzerim out there. Then Rav Moshe disagreed with Rav Henkin. And you could argue, Rav Moshe has many points in other post-scheme that... Rav Moshe's significance is not the civil marriage so much, although he debated for 30 years with Rav Henkin, it's the reform marriage. But you could say that if people choose to go be civilly married when they could get a Jewish marriage, that shows that they don't really value marriage, and therefore they're living in, as you know, in Zanus. You know, you can make various arguments. And Rav Moshe makes these arguments. But the dispute soon branched out into reform marriage, and that's where Rav Moshe was really radical and very significant, because you had many poskim who, in fact, I would say most poskim disagreed with Rav Henkin, and most poskim held that a reform marriage, that a civil marriage was not a marriage. But Rav Moshe was the first, and to this day, other than Rav Avadya Yosef, who came followed him, in his day, Rav Moshe was the only posek who said that a reform marriage is not a marriage. Because what's a reform marriage? Here you're dealing with people who are not Orthodox. They don't know anything about Torah. When it's time for them to get married, they go to their rabbi. They certainly intend to get married. It's not like a civil marriage where you could say they didn't intend to have a Jewish marriage. For them, that's a Jewish marriage. The man gives the woman the ring, and then they live together. How could they not be married? They've done everything they need to do. And if you're going to tell me, the person who performed the ceremony is a reform rabbi, well, I'll say, so what? We don't need rabbis at weddings. It's become the practice for us to use rabbis so as to prevent errors from arising. Already the Gemara says that no one should be involved in marriages unless they're expert in it. So that's why we use rabbis. But the rabbi doesn't function as a Catholic priest. This isn't a sacrament. The rabbi is not affecting any change, as it were. If you pay attention... I'll get to the Adim in a second. What do you need Adim for? The whole world is an Adim. Hey, after they perform this... they then go live together. The whole world are the Adim. The Adim don't need to be at the giving of the ring. The Adim could be for the Bia, which is the Yichud. And if you're going to tell me that the rabbi performs the ceremony, so what? Look at the next time you're at the wedding, what goes on. And you can see that the rabbi does not really perform any role other than directing traffic. Today, we also let the rabbi say a few words. The rabbis might not like it, but if we got rid of the few words under the chuppah, the marriage would be just as binding. What are crucial are the witnesses, and that becomes a complicated machokas between Rav Moshe and all the other poskim. You know, what are the witnesses that we're talking about? I'll read the question in a minute. The ketubah, the giving the ring, the brachos. For none of these, you need a rabbi. And in fact, some of the more avant-garde Orthodox today are allowing women to read the brachos. Now, what do we have here from Maddie? Well, Rav Moshe, wait till you hear what Rav Moshe says. The whole notion that we can be mevatel or reform marriages goes back to Rav Moshe. All the other poskim disagreed with him. And also, in terms of the document that goes to the government, you can become an online life minister, and you can do that. So the question is, how can reform marriage not be valid? How could it not be valid? Everything is done. By the same logic, though, we'd have hundreds of thousands of mamzerim. Rav Moshe was the first posek to state without hesitation that a reform wedding has no halachic significance. This seems to be in direct contradiction to the Chasam Sofer and many others. Now, you might be thinking this is an outrageous psak, a very cruel psak. You're telling hundreds of thousands of people that they're not married, but yet we will see that this is also a very psak with very great rachmanus, a very loving psak, as we'll see, and the most important psak of modern times. And let me explain. The most merciful psak ever given to Klal Yisrael. So it's a chumrah only from one standpoint. It's this psak that allowed the Jewish people to remain as one people. Other than Rav Moshe, no other posek held this way. So, as I said, subsequent to Rav Moshe, it was held by Rav Avadia, and then a lot of rabbanim followed this, but no posek independently. Without this psak, the Orthodox would not be permitted to marry the Reform. Now, most Orthodox are not marrying Reform, but no Balei Tshuva, nothing. The Orthodox would have had to declare the Reform, like the Karaites, there can be no more intermarriage, no more mixing, we can't perform their wedding ceremonies, we can't have any, it would have been two communities, it would have had to be completely separate because of their yichus. Without Rav Moshe's psak, there could have been no Kiruv movement, there could have been no outreach, nothing, because we could not bring them into our community. So it is hard to overestimate the significance of Rav Moshe's psak. Rav Soloveitchik didn't agree with Rav Moshe's psak, at least l'chachila, even. Yes, Rav Moshe, Rabbi Kellen makes a good point, and when we spoke about Rabbi Weinberg, Rabbi Weinberg showed us what his meta-halachic justification was. Rav Moshe doesn't tell us, but obviously this is in his mind, this is Shas HaTchak, we're trying to keep the Jewish people together. Rav Moshe holds l'chachila, if you can get a get, but if you can't, the Rav agreed l'chachila with Rav Henkin, whether he would so much so declare a kid a mom there, that we don't know. But Rav Moshe, once he gave his psak, then that's what allowed the Jewish people to remain together. Now, Rav Yechirach of Weinberg, I'll tell you, was very opposed to Rav Moshe's psak. He says he's not going to come out against him publicly, but he says it's wrong. I discovered when I was in Israel in January about 60 pages of a transcript of an interview Rabbi Weinberg gave, and it's full of harsh stuff, which I won't be able to publish. If I try to publish that, they're really going to come after me. If you thought the Torah Mada Journal was creating controversy. But among the things that he does is he blasts Rav Moshe. He says, as far as I'm concerned, Rav Moshe is not a rabbi in this area. He says, who needs a rabbi? Who cares? Rav Moshe says it's a reform rabbi. Reform rabbis don't follow the laws, that they don't, the man doesn't give the woman a ring. The Sridi Yesh says, what's he talking about? We don't need a rabbi. Who needs a rabbi for a wedding? As long as the man does it. And he goes on for pages, like four or five pages. Rav Moshe doesn't know what he's talking about. These people are completely married. And that was the standard psak before Rav Moshe. Whoever said in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, whoever heard of saying that Reformed Jews are not married? That when a Reformed Jew gets divorced, they don't need a get. Well, I mean, we are fortunate that very few Reformed Jews got divorced. And many of them who got divorced in Germany and places like that, they would get gittin. So the issue really didn't become controversial. Okay, now you ask about conservative. I'm looking at the time. Let me quickly talk about conservative. We still have about 15 minutes. Okay, now Rabbi Kel asked a good question. What about Balei Tshuva? I did some asking, because it appeared to me, at least, that we were only holding by Rav Moshe when it came to not getting a get. That is, a man gets divorced, the woman can't get a get, therefore we're willing to say that she doesn't need a get if we can't help it, and the children are fine. And if we can get a get, we'll get a get. But it's only in that sense, Shas HaTchak. And my assumption was that generally, we hold by Rav Henkin, with civil marriage and certainly with reform marriages, that they're married. We don't tell Balei Tshuva to get remarried and etc. I asked around, I called Rabbi Mintz, I emailed Rabbi Mintz and others, and it turns out my sense is that among the modern Orthodox rabbis, and Rabbi Kelman, you're in the field, you can correct me, that is true. But among the Lubavitch and many of the Eishes Torah types, now the Lakewood, they often do try to do a new ceremony, whether they feel it's nidu l'chadchila or more of a sense that now you're becoming frum. For some of them, it's a sense that now you're becoming frum, let's do it right. Not that the marriage is invalid, but I will tell you that there, and the one I spoke to in New Jersey, he never pushes it, he doesn't feel you need to do it, but they come to him often. The Balei Tshuva say, well, now they want to get married halachically. He doesn't push the issue. But you do, I'm sure you do have people who push the issue, and but in generally, at least in the modern Orthodox world, I spoke to, I believe it was two rabbis, and they both said that it's not an issue. That basically we assume, like Rav Henkin and the rest, that if you live together publicly for all these years, the witnesses are the people who see you, and that's what makes the marriage. And I see it's already 10 o'clock. Next class, before we get to Rav Avadia, I still need to discuss maybe 15 more minutes about the conservative issue and about Rav Moshe Feinstein's great psak on artificial insemination, which brought down the wrath of everyone, and then talk about what I think is a really disappointing psak of Rav Moshe, although Rav Moshe, from his standpoint, had no choice but to do that, and we can appreciate and admire his honesty, but I think it's a very sad psak. And so now time for some questions. We actually went a little long. I thought we'd finish it today, but this is great stuff, so God willing, we'll continue it next week as well. Any questions or comments? No, it's not hypocritical. We do this sort of thing all the time. Basically, the assumption would be that we hold like Rav Henkin. When I say Rav Henkin, especially with reform marriages, we hold like most poskim. But if it's a shas adchak, we go by the das yachid, we go by the minority opinion. The Mishnah in Eduyos already says, why is the minority opinion recorded? In case it's an emergency, you need to rely on it. Every Rav, my grandmother was listening to a talk last week, and she told me, reminded her, when she was young, her parents had a kosher butcher shop, she'd take the chicken to the rabbi, and sometimes she'd take it Erev Shabbos, and the rabbi would give a decision. And he wouldn't want to give this decision, but he had to give that decision because it's Erev Shabbos, it's a problem. And that's, my grandmother doesn't know this, but this is explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch. If a Rav is asked a Shaila, you give one psak, but if it's Erev Shabbos, if you have no chance to get another chicken, if guests are coming, the psak, you're supposed to then follow lenient opinions. In other words, the lenient opinions are there. So to say that we rely on Rav Moshe in an extreme circumstance, that's the way psak always works. So it's not hypocritical. It will be not at all. Why would we be two people? We'd be two people because every single reform and pretty much every reform, now with 50% divorce rate, every reform and every every reform and every civil marriage person, every other one would be remarrying. All their children would be mamzerim. After two generations, it would be impossible to do checking anymore. And therefore, the psak was, you found it in the Ramah, by the Karaites, you can't check anymore. Too much time has passed. Therefore, we simply just can't marry them. And that would be the psak with the reform and with the non-affiliated. We wouldn't be able to marry with them. They'd have a chazakah of mamzerim. There'd be no way around it. The smoking psak is the one I'm going to talk about next class, where Rav Moshe, it is a very disappointing psak, and he could have saved many lives had he not given that psak. On the other hand, what choice did he have? That was the halacha for reasons that we'll talk about. So it's a tragic psak, but really it shows his honesty. What he wanted, he was attacked for this, that he should have ruled its usser to save, you're asking Rav Moshe then to lie? To distort the Torah? Well, it's a complicated issue. That is actually how I'm going to end my Rav Moshe lectures. I don't understand, Rabbi Hirsch, about the purpose of Jewish... Oh, you're talking about the smoking issue? JJ, why can't we not use that kind of pattern in the retrograde when the issue comes up? I will talk... The next issue I want to speak about is Rav Moshe, because the Rachman Basin uses Rav Moshe. They claim to be following Rav Moshe. We do retroactively invalidate all non-Orthodox marriages, even conservative marriages, we'll see, based on Ramosha. But you can't do that with an Orthodox marriage. Ramosha did it. He did it a number of times. The Rachman based, and as we'll see, they claim to be following Ramosha. It's very dubious. Certainly, Ramosha didn't go that far. But you can't invalidate an Orthodox marriage. You can. Ramosha said you can invalidate the other marriages. Yeah, Ramosha had this dispute with Rav Henkin and went on for 30 years. Rav Henkin wrote like 4 svarim focusing on this thing. Rabbi Hirsch, we follow variant opinions a lot, though. That's why the Shulchan Aruch often springs in Yesh Omrim. So I know a lot of people wonder, why did the Shulchan Aruch bring in Yesh Omrim? It's a code. If you look in most codes of law, they tell you what the law is. Why is the Shulchan Aruch such... Look in the Rambam. But why is the Shulchan Aruch such a strange code? It tells you what the law is, and then it says Yesh Omrim. Because there are times when you need the Yesh Omrim. Generally, we don't rely on Ramosha. We try to get a get. We try to... we assume people are married. But, I mean, for inheritance and all these things, we assume that these people are married. But if it's a Shas HaTachak, isn't that what the Sri Yesh wrote about also? That when it's a Shas HaTachak, you can rely on individual opinions. Ramosha could be a Das Yachid. I don't know if any more he is, because many people now, big Rabbanim, hold by him. But certainly in his lifetime, he was a minority opinion with regard to Reform marriages, obviously, about Reform marriages. But why is that inconsistent? It's a Shas HaTachak. You're trying to save an Aguna. We're supposed to try to find every kula we can to try to save an aguna. And believe me, they rely on things a lot worse than Ramosha. Ramosha was a posek hador. Truthfully, you don't even need to call him a das yachid. Ramosha is of the status that he can go against everyone. Yes, Rafalevi. Rav Chaim David Alevi was the first one, to my knowledge, to rule that smoking was forbidden. He was followed by the Tzitz Eliezer. Today, I don't know of any, certainly no posek in the modern Orthodox world. I don't even know if any mainstream Haredi posek says that smoking is mutter. It annoys me to no end when I see the Hasidim smoking. But I assume their poskim hold that smoking is permissible. Okay, since you say smoking, Rav Moshe was very opposed to smoking. He says you can't smoke in the yeshiva, it's a bad thing, but he says you can't forbid it. You can't say that the person does it is a sinner. And this is an important distinction, because there's Rabbi, for example, Mordechai Halpern, who's a big rabbi scientist in Israel and others, they hold that a smoker is not allowed to be given an aliyah. A smoker is not allowed to be given a... They hold a smoker is not allowed to be a witness in a marriage. They hold that a smoker is a terrible sinner, the equivalent of Machal Shabbos. If you really feel that this is such a terrible thing, as I think many people do, you have to follow it through. Rav Moshe, I think, was worried about the slippery slope. He has a couple of tshuvas. He wasn't aware. I don't know if he was aware of everything. You can ask Rav Tenler. I bet you Rav Tenler today would say that if Rav Moshe was alive now, he would answer it. But Rav Moshe, I think, was afraid of the slippery slope. Where do you draw the line? What about fatty foods? What about the fact, then, that if it's really usher, what about the people who don't listen to it? Are we now going to say, like Rabbi Halpern says, you can't count him, let's say, maybe to a minion, or you can't, he certainly cannot be an aide. According, if you take seriously that smoking is injuring your life, it's a terrible sin you're violating, such a person cannot be a witness for a wedding. Are we now going to start asking people, do you smoke? Do you do things? I mean, if you want to be consistent, maybe yes. But I think Ramosha was worried. Ramosha says, there's this idea that if everyone does something, where are you going to draw the, what then, about driving over the speed limit? I think today you can't make the argument. The danger is so apparent. But in Ramosha's day, smoking was so popular to declare that all these people were sinners. Maybe he loved Jews too much. He couldn't bear to declare themselves sinners. You know what it means to say that someone's committing suicide? What a sinner it is that he's committing suicide. Okay. questions.
I think smoking's a big issue for people.
Yeah. I think it's, today, obviously, the younger generation, we're obviously, most of us find it abhorrent. And it's hard to believe how anyone could smoke and consider himself a religious person. But, you know, people can't help it sometimes. They get addicted to it.
As Rabbi Tamer says, it's worse than eating pork.
Yeah, but if you say that, if Rabbi Tengelroy says it, then such a person cannot be a witness. Such a person has as many halach problems then with such a person. And I don't think we're going... I don't think Ramosha say Greg Adolin did it, so it must be so. I don't think so. And that's the Hasidic approach. He simply says that if everyone does something, and he's not just referring to, I think, he's referring to pious people in general, not just Adolin.
Shomer Pesayim Hashem.
He's saying that this is the sort of thing, what Shomer Pesayim Hashem means, God watches over you, means that if it's something that everyone does, it has sort of an inbound acceptance. You can't say that it's such a dangerous thing. But that only applies if it's a suffix. If it's well known that it's dangerous, you're right, so. But if Ramosha would have offered it, the people wouldn't have stopped. At least many of them wouldn't have. I didn't know that about the Gerach Hasidim. That's interesting. Look, the Gerach Rebbe now offered computers. We'll see if they listen to that. I don't think so. In Israel, as all of you know, smoking is everywhere. Yeah. So you're right, it's a problem. Let me just conclude with that then, which I was going to talk about next class. This one rabbi wrote about Ramosha, and he said that Ramosha made a terrible mistake. Had Ramosha ostered smoking, he could have saved lives. And so it is a very disappointing psak. On the other hand, what does this rabbi want Ramosha to do? Ramosha thinks he doesn't think it's a good thing, but he doesn't think it's technically forbidden. Should Ramosha therefore have lied? Should Ramosha have made up the halacha for some larger purpose? Maybe, but that we'd have to get into a big discussion. Are you allowed to twist halacha in the name of some larger goal? Ramosha didn't do that. He gave what he thought was halacha, that technically you can't say that it's forbidden to smoke. Not everything that's stupid in life is forbidden. I don't know if it's forbidden to drive 75 miles an hour when it's a 60-mile speed limit. I don't know if it's forbidden to eat, you know, fatty foods. Not everything that's stupid is forbidden. That's Ramosha's position. Yeah, but Ramosha didn't really have the Mediterranean approach. I mean, he's in America. In those days, everyone smoked. You know that. It was hard to... Ramosha's newspaper, Yom Layom, the Shas newspaper, no longer takes ads for cigarettes, and they did declare in the newspaper that it's forbidden, which presumably nothing gets in that newspaper if Ramosha doesn't permit it. Rav Yashiv won't come out against it because... he probably holds like Rav Moshe that everyone smokes. And remember, in Israel also, they don't know about the health issues, and it's hard to say. I don't know. What I can say is it's very hard to take someone seriously as a rabbi if they do smoke, at least if they smoke publicly so we can see them smoke. I don't know. Some people, it's very hard. The Rav Baruch Bar Leibovich had a terrible smoking addiction, and on Shabbos, he would put all his old cigarettes into a little canister, and he'd open it up and smell it on Shabbos. Look, I don't know. It's a problem. It's not really a problem in the modern world. It's more a problem in the Haredi world in Israel, where they're smoking everywhere. Rav Avadia's newspaper, Yom Layom, the Shas newspaper, no longer takes ads for smoking, and it came out and said smoking's forbidden. So that's the Shas position. I don't know, though, if he's actually said halachically it's forbidden, or that's just more of a propaganda type of statement. But I don't know that Tzitzeliezer ruled it's us, or every post-take who has read the literature, every post-take who's aware of modern science says it's us, sir. So, as far as I know, I assume Shmuel Rav Schechter says it's us, sir, also.
Mark, if I yes. may, and by this I'll let you go, but for next week, and since I'm smoking, I'm just interested in your comments, and there are two that come to my mind. Ramosha gave these, like, wild shubas that are, like, off the wall, that I don't know what to make of them. Like, marrying a balas tshuva, you know, it's a begam because it's a bas nida. So instead of saying, what's the big deal? It's no begam, it's not us. Or marry bas nida has this, like, really convoluted tshuva, how the woman must have gone swimming on the Sunday, which makes absolutely no sense because where was her bedikas?
And
the other tshuva,
yeah.
Of course, on the regents. When the people stole the regents' exams, so he says, you can't believe it, it's not true. And I find it hard to believe Ramosha actually believed what he wrote. And, like, I mean, Manavshach, like, you know, he was doing because he wants, I don't want to say he had an agenda, he was the greatest poet, you know, Ramosha was saying, like, Chas v'Shalom for me to say one iota bad against et cetera, the great post-it of the 20th century. But I just find these like troops document. There's one more that escapes my mind now that is just also just so strange, I can't figure it out. Comment on it next week if you don't want to do it.
Yeah, no, I just say the first Psak, I mean, look, the Stipler and all of them basically said, you know, if someone's abolished tshuva, then obviously there's no pogrom. Why Rav Moshe went that way, I've discussed this with Rabbi Linzer and others. It's a very strange tshuva. The second one is more interesting, because Rav Moshe knew very well about corruption and how from Jews cheat. In his own yeshiva, Mesiv Tzeres Shlaim, there was some money laundering scandal, and, you know, so among the administrator there, he knew very well. So, I don't know. It's maybe trying to give chizuk to the people. Who knows? You're right. It's strange. I will quote you next class another tshuva Rav Moshe, which is very strange, where he seems to contradict himself and go against. There's strange elements to it, but on the whole, you don't find this. I don't know what to make of it. You're right. There's a very unusual, and people have written about it. I don't know. It's a good question. You know, sometimes Rabbi Kelman just illustrated is the problem I often have with Tosfos. You know, the questions are often better than the answers. So, you know, I don't think there's any problem in saying, I don't know. It's an excellent question. Okay, look, thank you, everyone. We will pick up next week. We only have about 10 more minutes. I want to say more about Rav Moshe, but some really interesting stuff. And then we'll move into the Posek, who really follows Rav Moshe. Rav Avadya, as Fariz I'll explain, is Rav Moshe's successor, if you can believe it. How could Rav Avadya be Rav Moshe's successor? Because only Rav Avadya and Rav Moshe deal with the issues they deal with. Only them speak to the community, the larger community. Only Rav Avadya, just like Rav Moshe, is concerned about the non-religious Jew living in Netivot. Like Rav Moshe wrote Shua to rabbis living, as I said, in Lansing, Michigan, you know, where everyone was Mechal Shabbos. Rav Yashav isn't answering Shilas to people like that. They're all from Jews. So Rav Avadya really continues on the Rav Moshe, you know, the authority and of the achrayus, the responsibility. So it'll be a very good segue from Rav Moshe, from one Posek Hador to the next Posek Hador. So everyone, I wish you all a very good Shavuos, and look forward, God willing, and on our Memorial Day, at least I will be here on Memorial Day. My barbecue will be finished. It's at the rabbi's house, believe it or not. Our rabbi of our show has a big barbecue every Memorial Day, Rabbi Spivak. But we will be done with Mincha. It will be around 8, and I will be back here by 9. So hope
broadcast
to see you all next
from
week.
The rabbi's house. Bring everybody on board from the rabbi's house in the shul.
Yeah, just set it up. He's actually a very good computer. He used to be head of your computers at YU. So he ran the YU Torah.org website. This year he's now at SAR. So if you like the YU Torah.org website, which has a lot of good stuff, my rabbi, young guy, he developed the website. So he's certainly very computer literate. I'll mention that to him next week.
What's his name? What's the rabbi's name?
Mark Spivak. He's younger than you. He's the one who really developed the website and. Yeah, he's the rabbi of our little shul, Or Torah, here in West Orange, New Jersey. We have a very big shul, and then we have our, not such a small shul, we have 100 families now, but it started very small. So, very good, everyone. God willing, see you next week. Have a good chag. Bye-bye.